That a talk about moisture characteristic curves would be would fit pretty well in this symposium because it crosses over from soil physics pretty well into geotechnical engineering. I think most of the people here are interested in that. Okay. I'll try and speak up a little. Okay, pretty sure most everybody here knows what a moisture characteristic curve is. It's simply the relationship between water content of a material and the water potential or soil suction of that material. So why do we care about moisture characteristic curves? Well, they're useful for many, many things. Certainly the agronomists and plant people like them to understand plant available water, and the geotech folks use them for a few different things. You can understand things like the specific surface area of soils. I guess Marcus Tuller is going to give a presentation a little bit later talking about some of the work that he's done with that. You can also understand the expansive coefficient or the shrink swell potential of soils if you measure the soil moisture characteristic curves. And there are a lot of other applications in unsaturated soil mechanics and geotechnical engineering. So how do you measure these curves? And this is where we're going with the talk, is some of the differences in results you might get if you use different measurement techniques. The far left, you'll see lady using a tension table, which pulls a suction or a negative potential on the soil water. Tensiometer would be used in the same manner. And then on the far right, you see a vapor pressure technique. Each of these techniques that might be used have their own set of drawbacks. And one of the main drawbacks you'll see is the range of measurement. So let's see if I can get the pointer here. A lot of the tensiometer-based techniques only really work in the wet end, and the vapor pressure techniques kind of kick in the dry end. And often there's a little bit of a disconnect in this area between the wet end techniques and the dry end techniques. And one of the downfalls of some of the techniques that actually impose a suction or a negative water potential on, or negative pressure on the soil water, is that you can only pull a vacuum down to about -1 bar. Okay, you can only go to absolute zero pressure. So you can get down to -100 kilopascals, -1 bar, -1 atmosphere. Axis translation, or the pressure plate technique, is a little bit different in that you are imposing a positive pressure on the soil and creating a delta potential or a delta pressure that can go much higher than that 1 bar pressure that you're constrained to with some of the other techniques. Now, the techniques that put a negative pressure, a negative potential on the water, are a lot more representative of what you see in nature. Okay, you never see a soil under a positive pressure. Okay, this just isn't something that that's very common. And so the question is whether or not putting a positive pressure across the soil gives you the same results. With the axis translation or pressure plate technique, just to give you a quick rundown of that for those who haven't used this, soil is generally put in contact with a porous plate and then sealed in a chamber. The outflow of that porous plate is at atmospheric pressure, and then the chamber is pressurized to achieve a delta pressure, okay, that is much higher, as I said, than what you can achieve if you're actually pulling a tension on that soil water. And so you can see pressure plates are an example of this, and also Tempe cells are commonly used with a positive pressure induced. The effectiveness of the axis translation technique has been questioned at the dry end quite a bit. If you were in the S1 session this morning, you saw some work by Glendon Gee that showed that even if you impose or equilibrate a sample at negative 1.5 megapascals, then those samples may only reach negative 0.5 megapascals. Okay, there are problems with hydraulic discontinuities between the sample and the plate, and also problems in that you have very low unsaturated hydraulic conductivities at those low water potentials that cause equilibrium times to become extremely long and maybe even infinity. You may never reach the -1.5 megapascal number that people want for a permanent wilting point number. Okay, so there's some skepticism about the effectiveness of the pressure plates at the very dry end, but generally the assumption has been made that those work pretty well in the wet end, okay, down through maybe negative 500 kilopascals, a pretty good technique. But There's been some recent research done by Danny Orr and Marcus Tuller originally, and then that concept was picked up by some of the geotechno folks, Baker and Friedman, that wrote a paper in 2009 saying that the fundamental mechanisms for draining pores under positive pressure are different than those from draining pores under a negative pressure or a tension. And to give a real brief explanation, I pulled some figures from Danny and Marcus's paper, and you can see that in a two-pore size system that you have here, that this is the positive pressure. This is the pressure plate or axis translation scenario where you have a positive pressure on one end and an atmospheric pressure on the other. This pore begins to drain based on the smaller radius, the radius of the small pore. Whereas in a real system, when you have atmospheric pressure on one end and a negative pressure or a tension on the other end, then it's this R1, or the radius of the large pore, that causes the drainage, that causes the cavitation of that pore. And if you look at the lower figure, you see that a theoretical set of soil moisture characteristic curves. Okay, and this is the case where you have the positive pressure. This is the pressure plate case where water doesn't begin to drain until you hit a relatively high suction or low potential, because it's governed by this smaller radius. Whereas in the case of a negative potential or a tension being pulled on the water, that cavitation actually occurs based on the radius of the large pore. Okay, so there's a theoretical basis for questioning whether the moisture characteristic curves for these two fundamental types of techniques are even equivalent. And the theory says no, they're not. So the rationale behind our research was to actually experimentally look at this and see if there are measurable and significant differences in the moisture characteristic curves determined under pressure versus those determined under suction. Okay, so the experiment that we put together, we used a pressure plate extractor apparatus, and we basically ran a paired study. We ran a set of samples under positive pressure in the standard configuration, and then we reversed it and held the chamber at atmospheric pressure and pulled a suction on the outflow instead of putting a pressure inside the chamber. Okay, we held the remainder of the apparatus constant, okay, to make sure that there was no bias. Used the same pressure plate apparatus, used the same pressure transducer, just turned around, differential pressure transducer, used the same equilibration time at each water potential step to make sure that that if we weren't in equilibrium, at least we were in disequilibrium at the same point between the two studies. We ran triplicate samples of five different porous materials. We ran a couple of non-soil materials, a silica flour and a diatomaceous earth, and then we ran some sand, some sandy loam, and some silt loam. So kind of an order of complication there, from some non-soil materials all the way down to some materials with a reasonable clay content. We're pretty careful to have the same bulk density in those materials, okay? And then we started these at saturation, and did pressure steps of negative 5, negative 10, and negative 20 kilopascals. And you're probably asking, why did they only do three pressure steps? And the answer is, we've only done three pressure steps so far. Okay, we're still in the process of this. So here are the results. Here are soil moisture characteristic curves. Here's the silica flour. You'll notice that the blue data are the ones that were created under positive pressure. The red were under tension. And the error bars represent one standard deviation. Okay, these were triplicate samples, so it gives you an idea of the reproducibility, at least. Certainly, there are significant differences in the silica flour with the, as predicted, with the samples that were created under a positive pressure holding more water than the samples that were created under tension. Here's the diatomaceous earth, also similar. Notice the last point, as we get down toward negative 20 kilopascals, we start to see some convergence of those results. Fine sand, very large differences, certainly at the wet end, and then complete convergence as we dry out. Similar Actually, once you start getting into the finer grain materials, I think we're bumping up against the air entry of the material, but always the pressure samples hold more water. And here's our silt loam, and you'll see up here that we haven't actually, at negative 10 kilopascals, reached air entry. But once you reach air entry, then you observe the same types of errors between that, or the same types of differences between the two techniques. And so when I was looking at these data, I thought, wow, this is great. You know, we've really come up with something, you know, interesting here and experimentally proven these results that Danny and Marcus gave us the nice theory on. But while I was on the airplane ride on the way here, I was looking back at the Orr and Tuller paper and the Baker and Friedman paper, and noticed a reference in there to a work from 1965 that looked like it might have some experimental results in it. So I quickly sent a text to my technician, and he looked up the paper for me. And come to find out, we are indeed retreading work that was done in 1965. So this is a piece of work by a couple of guys at McGill University that shows exactly what we're finding already. Okay, that these are moisture characteristic curves for unsaturated, what is it, initially saturated coarse silt. Both of these are coarse silt, and you can see clearly the divergence between the two methods, and again a convergence much as we're seeing as you get to lower water potentials. And this just underscores something that that Galen Campbell tells me about every time we come home from these meetings. He always complains that the younger soil physicists are simply retreading ground that's been already plowed 4 or 5 decades ago, and now I'm guilty as charged of doing the same. But I think it's still interesting, and I'm glad we spent a little bit of time looking at this, and I think that our results certainly confirm the work, the old work of Shahal and Young, and also the newer works of Orr and Tuller and Baker and Friedman. And the real bottom line here is that this calls into question, in my mind, just how effective pressure plates and axis translation is at generating a realistic moisture characteristic curve. I mean, we already know they have some problems at the dry end, and now it looks like there's some pretty serious problems at the wet end as you're in the air entry range. So that's what I had for you today. Thanks.
Yeah, many thanks for the lecture and for open for questions. It's all clear? No, can't be. Here we are.
Yeah, Tyson.
What do your results imply about the temperature dependence of the water temperature?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think in Danny and Marcus's paper, they actually went through the thermodynamics of what happens when a pore cavitates and some of the energy that it takes that you have to overcome before you get to that cavitation process. And when I was reading through that, I didn't pay real close attention to it, so I wouldn't want to venture a concrete guess as to what difference that makes. But when you're looking at thermodynamics, then it absolutely is going to make a difference. So that's a really good question, and it's probably addressed in that 2002 paper. Yeah.
Okay. Next question.
Yeah. I just wanted to follow up.
No, that's a good question, and I think that I didn't do a very good job of explaining our experimental setup. We actually used, so there was no hysteresis. We didn't dry down and wet back up. What we did was take a set of samples down under the one regime, under the pressure regime, and then used a separate set of samples at the same bulk density and went down using tension instead of pressure. Yeah.
Okay, what? Further questions? Well, if not, I have another one. Well, always we have to think about the rigidity of systems, which means what happens if you have an air pressure or have a suction mm-hmm. on the rigidity of systems, mm-hmm. because as soon as you exceed that point, which means you have a shrinkage, you change the volume, and then your retention curve is gone.
Yeah, I agree that there's certainly issues there with the rigidity of the system, but I would almost expect that if you're putting pressure on a system and you collapse that system, that you'd squeeze more water out of the system, as opposed to what we saw here, where there's actually more water held in the system with that's been treated under pressure. But actually, both of the papers I pointed to talk about some issues with the difference in the curvature of the air-water interface that's caused by putting that positive pressure on it. And so there are even other issues that are at play when you're dealing in the positive pressure regime.
Yeah. But did you ever measure the height change while pressurizing or putting some?
No.
Because that would be needed in order to be at least sure that you have this boundary condition defined.
Yeah,
otherwise you're wrong.
That's a very good point, and we did not do that, but that is an interesting thing and probably should be addressed.